You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. And it's Friday. That means it's time for our reporter roundtable, when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this week. Today, our panel includes Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, and the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, and Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com. Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Hey, Sam. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Oh, my gosh. Where to begin? This week has been crazy. Let's start with Governor Brad Little calling a special session of the Idaho legislature to consider cutting taxes and put more money into education. Scott, Betsy, Clark, you all wrote about this. Where do we want to start? Betsy, I'm going to throw it out to you first.
Okay, so this is big news. The Idaho legislature will be convening in special session next week on September 1st to take up a single bill that's been proposed by the governor that would cut income taxes, give a big immediate income tax rebate to every Idahoan who files a return, and also increase school funding, both K-12 public school funding and some for higher education permanently every year going forward into the future by tapping into basically the huge state surplus that we have. That's what would pay for all of this. And it would not, these changes would not be one time. They would be permanent. The only thing that's one time about it is the rebate. And a big difference between the rebate that's being proposed this time and the previous ones is the minimum amount. The minimum amount will be $300 per person, or $600 for a married couple who files jointly. The previous minimum was $75. So there's a whole lot there. And the governor has gotten more than a majority of each house signed on to this bill as co-sponsors, suggesting that it will easily pass.
Clark, you broke down a lot of the numbers in your story. Don't get too wonky, but we're talking about moving a lot of money around.
Yeah, absolutely. The way that Governor Little and his aides and supporters promoted this on Tuesday when they made the announcement, they're calling it the largest investment in education funding in state history, and they're calling it the largest tax cut in state history, both together in this one bill that Betsy described. So yeah, we're talking $330 million per year for K-12 public schools. We're talking another $80 million a year for what they're calling in-demand career training. This could go a couple of different ways. It could go to career technical education programs that we have in our public schools. Think of programs like shop classes and woodworking and things of that nature. But it could also go to our community colleges, and it could also go to our four-year colleges and universities. And so, yeah, the supporters of it are talking about it in terms of the largest tax cut, the largest investment in education in state history. And it's a huge proposal. There's a 14-page bill that they've already shared that a lot of us have published with our articles. But it gets really interesting when we talk about the money involved, but we talk about the political implications, which I know we'll get to in a minute, but the timing and the political implications. But yeah, this is how supporters are setting it up. Is these huge increases, like historic in terms of state history, is how they're promoting this package.
And I should mention that the way the governor framed this is that this is a response to our historic inflation that we're experiencing right now, that in the face of this huge inflation, that it's a big burden, as the governor put it, not only on Idahoans, but also on our school system, our education system, and our businesses, which need trained workers, that the response is to basically determine that the top priorities for spending the surplus and doing so right away are tax relief and education.
Okay, before we get into the education, let's stick with what Clark brought up. And Scott, let's get you in here because you talked about this too. So the first thing that came to my mind with the tax rebate proposal, which comes, and I looked at the calendar, just about 2 months before Election Day, is this about the pain of inflation, as Betsy said, the governor says, or is this about politics? I mean, lawmakers in the Idaho legislature voting to give their constituents a tax rebate 2 months before election day. Is that, am I just, you know, creating a causality that isn't there?
Oh, perhaps not. Yeah, the timing is unmistakable. You know, it would come just a couple of months before the election, a tax rebate check. You know, special sessions are supposed to be just that. They're supposed to be special. You know, when you're addressing an emergency like 2 years ago, when the election laws needed to be changed in the midst of the pandemic, you could legitimately, reasonably argue that there is no need for an emergency for a special session in this case, that none of this, none of these moves, the rebate, the tax cut, the education funding, it's nothing that couldn't wait until January. And so I think it's a legitimate question whether this is going to, you know, be used as a political ploy to help some people get elected. I think more importantly, probably, what factors into this is the Quality Education Act. I think that this was a move to preempt that citizens initiative that is on the ballot in November. And with passage of this proposal as legislation, that would preempt that Quality Education Act in a number of ways. In a lot of people's minds, I think there are a lot of people who are maybe on the fence. They want to increase public education funding, but they're maybe a little hesitant about raising tax rates, corporate taxes, and the income tax rate for high earners. And this negates that hesitation for folks. They would say, you know, this is $410 million into public education funding. The Quality Education Act proposed $323 million of additional funding. And it does it without raising taxes. And that's one of the things, the criticisms of the Quality Education Act is like, why are we raising taxes if we've got a $2 billion surplus, budget surplus? Can't we increase funding for education without raising those income tax rates and the corporate tax rates? And this, by doing this, that achieves that. And so I think that the chances of the Quality Education Act passing have gone down dramatically if this does, you know, pass in the special session.
Well, and Betsy, back to you. I'm just scrolling through the Eye on Boise blog, which everybody should do every day because, wow. And you've got responses here from Luke Mabel, from the head of Reclaim Idaho. You've got Senate Democrats, House GOP, school boards, the Superintendent of Public Instruction of Idaho, the IEA Teachers Union, all responding to the education side of this. I don't know. What has the response been overall? Are people okay? Yes, we want more money for education and we'll get it any way we can, whether it's the Quality Education Act or through this bill?
Well, we know that for many, many, many years in Idaho, whenever voters are surveyed about what they think is the most important issue in Idaho and the most important thing to spend state tax money on, it's education. It has always been education. And we are seeing, I think, huge amounts of support for this proposal from the governor by education stakeholders because they want education funding to be increased. Now, Reclaim Idaho, the sponsors of the initiative, I thought Luke Mayville's statement was kind of interesting because he said there are some good things in here and there are some bad things in here. And he concluded that the good things actually outweighed the bad. However, one of the perhaps bad from his perspective things is that the governor's bill would specifically repeal the Reclaim Idaho initiative should the voters pass it. It does that by setting January 3rd as the effective date for its income tax law changes. And the Reclaim Idaho initiative, its income tax law changes would take effect January 1st. Mm. So then they would change 2 days later. So that's very clear. And there is precedent for this in Idaho. The last time that we had an initiative on the ballot to substantially increase education funding, and it looked very, very likely to pass, then Governor Jim Risch in 2006 called a special session of the legislature in August to pass a single bill that took all the wind out of the sails of that initiative. Now, that case was a little bit different because that initiative would have raised the sales tax from 5% to 6% and given all the additional money to schools. It was a penny for schools, and it was a very popular idea. What Governor Risch, then Governor Risch, got the legislature to do was to raise the sales tax from 5% to 6%, not to increase funding for education, but to provide property tax relief. And in some ways, it could be seen as a fairly cynical move, because in the long run, it ended up decreasing funding for education. That property tax relief that was granted was the removal of the basic property tax funding that schools had always relied on in Idaho in good times and bad times. And a state fund was set up to partially make that up, but it didn't make it up. And over the years since then, we've seen that supplemental levies have been passed by voters all across the state to fund the basic needs of school districts that were no longer funded from that basic property tax levy that used to have. And we've ended up losing all the property tax relief and having yet another property tax crisis on our hand, in addition to really varying funding levels between school districts. So in some ways, the governor's proposal here would fix that by actually increasing funding for schools from the state level and setting up a dedicated transfer from sales tax, in some ways, kind of what the 2006 initiative was trying to do. So this one actually would increase funding for schools, but it also clearly is intended to take the wind out of the sails of the voter initiative.
Well, that was the first thing. Go ahead, Clark.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think I agree with Betsy. And I think this thing, the closer you look at it, the more interesting it is. You know, the governor said on Tuesday that the governor's proposal for the special session had nothing to do with the Quality Education Act. But when I talked to Senator Janie Ward Engelking, who's a Boise Democrat, she said she doesn't think the legislature would be calling this special session and increasing education funding at such a similar level to the Quality Education Act without Reclaim Idaho, without the more than 70,000 Idahoans who signed a petition in order to get that ballot initiative on the November 8th election ballot that's coming up. Luke Mayville said a similar thing. I mean, they're essentially saying that, yeah, I know the governor's saying that these two things are not connected, but they're saying that without the Quality Education Act, without these 70,000 people who have already signed a petition, they don't think the legislature would be coming back in to take this up and consider this giant funding increase.
And Clark, I actually think they got more than 100,000 signatures. They got more than they needed.
Yeah, it was 70,000 verified, but they had more than 100,000 raw signatures turned in. But at the end of the day, what the Secretary of State signed off on was more than 70,000 valid signatures, things like where the address and the all that stuff checks out. But yeah, they had more than 100,000 names on the list at one point.
So one really big difference between the Reclaim Idaho initiative and the governor's bill is that the Reclaim Idaho initiative would have raised the corporate income tax from 6% to 8%. The governor's bill lowers the corporate income tax from 6% to 5.8%. I mean, it also provides some individual income tax relief and gives us a flat tax. It's a very significant proposal. But the real contrast is the corporate income tax between the two approaches.
Well, and maybe I'll throw this one, this last question here at Scott. As it stands now, the bill that has come out, and there is no guarantee that the bill will stay the bill on the special session on the 1st, but the bill that's come out as written that the governor is behind, and then the Reclaim Idaho initiative, have we heard, do we know, is there a general idea that one would be better than another, or is it just a general idea of more money to education, let's do it however we need to do it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the 5.8% income tax rate and corporate tax rate are very attractive. And we know that the legislature cut tax rates last year, and we still saw an increase in tax revenues. So the argument held out, and that was the argument, so that we're still seeing increased revenues, we're cutting taxes, we're still seeing an influx of people and businesses, and taxes are going up. So, you know, Betsy can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that Reclaim Idaho necessarily had to have a funding source in order to justify the $323 million funding for education. And so they had to put in a tax increase to account for that funding source. But you know, the governor's proposal raises all this money for education without raising taxes, and still leaves another $1 billion or so from the surplus that the legislature can work with in January, you know, for property tax relief or grocery tax relief.
Or so whatever else comes along.
I think it's a, you know, this proposal has been so widely hailed that I think this is a pretty good deal for a lot of people.
All right. So, Betsy, special session starts next Thursday?
8 a.m.
All right. And it's supposed to only be a day with...
That is their goal. It could go into that Friday, but it's probably not going to go into Labor Day weekend, which comes right after that.
Well, that's the timing is important there. Okay, so let's jump off the special session and talk about casinos. Because, wow, Margaret, are we about to get a casino at Mountain Home? Is that true?
We'll see. We might. So yesterday, I reported that two Indian tribes are looking at opening a casino near the intersection, the exit with the interstate just east of Mountain Home, the Shoshone Bannock, who also have three casinos on their Fort Hall reservation. They have bought a piece of property and are hoping to get a vote from tribal members on the topic next month. And then the Shoshone Paiute down in Duck Valley, who is the only Idaho tribe that does not have a casino, is also hoping to get one. They have sent a letter of intent to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they have partnered with an Owyhee County-based gaming developer that would like to for their own project, which would be on a parcel adjacent to the intersection. And there's a lot to talk about here. The first thing is that this project, particularly the Shoshone Bannock project, is big. They're looking at a 250-room hotel, a horse racing track, two movie theaters, multiple restaurants, 2,000 electronic gaming machines. It would be quite the operation, and that would be a big draw from the Treasure Valley. The other aspect here is exactly how to approve it. The land outside of Mountain Home that both tribes are looking at is not tribal land. So in order for them to build a casino on it, the tribe would need to go through a process of approval with the Department of the Interior. And then they would basically prove two things. They would have to prove that the casino would not be detrimental to the community. And they have to talk with other state and local officials, including other tribes. And then Governor Brad Little would have to approve it. So that opens up some complications because the Shoshone Paiute is they are angry. I talked to the chairman of the tribe yesterday morning, and he was pretty upset. He used the phrase bullying, and at one point in our conversation likened the interaction between the two tribes as Russia and Ukraine, with the Shoshone Paiute being Ukraine and the Shoshone Bannock being Russia in that situation, because they have so much money and power, and the Shoshone Paiute don't. And so they're hoping that they can make the case that it would be really unfair for the Shoshone Bannock to get that approval for a fourth casino whenever the Shoshone Paiute doesn't even have one, and they have a lot of people who are living with below the poverty line down there in Duck Valley. So they're going to be making their case that, hey, it would be detrimental to our community to give this casino permission to a tribe that is located on a reservation on the other side of Idaho. And there's some interesting legal precedent that I won't go into about exactly how you make the case, particularly once you start looking at building a casino on land that gets progressively further from your reservation. So this is going to be a big story, both on the debating gambling side on the development side, because it's such a big project and it would change Mountain Home. And then also on the Native American side, with these two tribes being essentially pitted against each other and trying to navigate that, with one tribe having a lot of money from casinos and another tribe not having as much.
Well, Margaret, that is an absolutely fascinating story. And it does make me think of what happened in the 1990s, the last time that we had an off-reservation casino proposed in Idaho. And that was when the Coeur d'Alene tribe wanted to build a casino where the Post Falls Greyhound Park is. And the one obstacle they ran up against was the governor's permission. Governor Batt said no. And so they developed their casino on their reservation. It's much more remote. It certainly doesn't do as much business as it would if it were on the interstate in the original site that they had selected. But I think one thing that you mentioned that's an interesting aspect of this is the inclusion of a horse racing track in mm-hmm. one of these projects. We currently have almost no horse racing left in Idaho, and there's a substantial political faction in Idaho that strongly supports bringing back horse racing and all of the attendant agriculturally related industry that goes with that. That might be a real draw for a governor of Idaho to want to approve something like this, to be able to bring back that industry in our state.
And the other thing that I think you mentioned, Margaret, was that for people in the Treasure Valley who aren't near, really, if you want to, I don't know how to define near, but near a casino at the moment, if one is built fairly close, I mean, that's, you've got a fairly large audience to draw from there of folks who would come to the casino.
Nate Shellman talked about this on his show yesterday afternoon. I listened for a little while, and the callers were pretty divided. Some of the callers were saying, heck yeah, I can't wait to go down to the casino. It'll bring, you know, more entertainment, more things to do, more economic vitality to Mountain Home. I look, gambling is fun. Let's do it. And then other people that were calling in were really worried. They were saying, I don't like gambling. I don't want a big casino in my small town of Mountain Home. All sorts of things. And so gambling is a divisive issue. There was a man on there who was concerned about a big casino coming closer to the Treasure Valley would enable people that maybe have gambling addictions or create new gambling addictions. So I think that sets up the conversation we're going to be having as these projects continue to move ahead. Is there aren't too many people who are take it or leave it on gambling. People are usually, they feel one way or the other. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see how the city of Mountain Home acts and the governor, all these different players as we, the collective we, watches this happen.
Yeah. And sometime when we have 3 or 4 hours, we can get into the history of gambling and how people in Idaho feel about it. It's a very big issue for sure. Okay, we're going to keep watching that. And I know you will keep watching that and keep us up to date. Scott and Betsy, you both wrote about a free market think tank coming out of Idaho. Let's see. Betsy, can you explain what it is? And Scott, explain why you have a few reservations, which I thought were very well put in your editorial. Betsy, start with you.
Sure. So the Mountain States Policy Center is planning to officially open in Idaho in October, and they describe themselves as a free market think tank. They are an offshoot of the Washington Policy Center, which is already existing in the state of Washington, and they want to serve Idaho and Montana and Eastern Washington and some other parts of our region. What's interesting is that we have an existing group that also initially described itself as a free market think tank and still does sometimes, the Idaho Freedom Foundation. And what they have essentially morphed into is an extremely active lobbying and campaign organization with multiple offshoots that do things like advertise against candidates and try to rev up their base. And they've taken very controversial positions. They are very secretive about their funding sources. They, in recent years, have refused to speak to the media about anything they do. And they rate Idaho legislators on how well they meet their agenda and encourage people to vote for or against them on that basis. This new group says they won't do any of that stuff. They will be, quote, the adults in the room and just talk about research on free market principles as they relate to Idaho issues. So we will see when they start up, and they have already sent out a few things, but they seem to have some fairly similar philosophies in some areas to the Idaho Freedom Foundation, and in others, not so much. But I think it is interesting that another group like that is saying they're going to start up here.
Scott, jump in here. You had some reservations.
Yeah, like Betsy mentioned, you know, the Mountain States Policy Center is a 501c3 nonprofit, which is the same tax exempt category that allows dark money to infiltrate state politics through anonymous donations. And so there's always going to be a question about their funding. Now, the new president, Chris Cargill, said that their research arm and their fundraising arms are completely separate. And so the fundraising doesn't affect their research that they do or the conclusions that they come to. But I think it'll always be a question, you know, whether that fundraising is influencing the research. You know, for example, school choice is clearly one of their topics that they're going to be talking about, and they're very much in favor of school choice. And it looks like they're, you know, they haven't really come out, they're just getting started. They haven't come out with specific policy positions, but they clearly are in favor of school vouchers. They've touted that in other states. And so, you know, is that because that will benefit Idaho and all Idahoans, or is it because it is being pushed by a group that would benefit from school vouchers? And so, you know, they're also affiliated with the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and the State Policy Network, which are both kind of associated with injecting conservative and libertarian ideals into state legislatures and kind of putting the thumb on the scale for corporate interests and putting them at the front of the line. So I still have reservations about whether these policy studies and research are real studies and research, or if they're just advocacy papers in favor of those who would benefit from proposed legislation.
Fascinating. Margaret, you did a deep dive into an irrigation district in West Boise. And no, I was not trying to be funny there. Can you tell us how you got started on this investigation? This one gets complicated.
Yeah, and I'll try not to get too in the weeds here. I got started on this when I was contacted by a woman who named Lois Fish, who lives in West Boise, and she got an email, or she got a lien in the mail on her house from a water user association called the Shaver Lateral Water User Association, and they said that she owed them over $600 and she had to pay. And a lien basically is a legal action, and they can use your house as collateral to satisfy a debt. And then I started reaching out and trying to learn more about water user associations, this one in particular. And during the course of that, I discovered this particular water user association has put liens on 7 houses since December of last year. And some of these bills are several hundred dollars, some of them over $1,000. And looking at the bills, they appeared to be billing, adding a lot of late fees and extra interest. So interest, 10% interest would be added every day instead of every year, which adds extra interest. There was a $75 collection fee. There was a $25 fee to review the account. So essentially what happened was Lois didn't pay her Shaver lateral bill. She says she was never billed. The association says they did bill her. It's disputed. She didn't pay her bill for 4 years. And these bills were less than $50, $30 to $40 a year. And it ballooned to over $600 in just a few years owed. So that tells you the kind of late fees and calculations they were adding. The Attorney General's office refused to comment to me on this, but they did review the charges on the account and sent a letter to the Shaver Lateral Association saying, hey, I need you to justify how these charges to your customers are legal. There's a lot we don't know. The Chevrolateral refused to tell me how many customers they have or show me a list of their customers. So I don't really have a sense of how many people are affected, although I do see that they serve several subdivisions, whole string of subdivisions over in West Boise, stretching toward Meridian. And other complaints were that folks had given up their water rights. They had no way to get water at their house. There was no canal at their house. Everyone I talked to had no access to water, and they were still being billed. And so they tried to, some of them tried to go to the association and say, hey, I want to legally give up my water right on my property. I want to get out of this. I'm tired of paying you $40 a year. I don't want to pay you $40 a year. And they were not permitted to leave. They basically were continued to be billed even if they had no legal right to irrigation water. So this is a really complicated issue, and it stretches back decades and decades to the early days when a lot of those properties out in the West Boise Meridian area were fields that had water rights to water crops. And then the field got divided up into subdivisions and houses, and all those houses had water rights. But not all of them, the vast majority of them, were located nowhere near the canal and couldn't even get that water. And then these little water user associations pop up in order to maintain that infrastructure. And they're not really regulated by anybody. It's kind of a Wild West thing.
It is kind of a Wild West thing. And I think a lot of folks may not know how many. I mean, there are so many of these little irrigation districts that are all over the area. I mean, even in the middle of Boise, and they have different rules and different water access. And I think you have opened up a window into just one of these scenarios. This sort of thing, maybe not all the questions about fees and bills, but you know, water users associations are just all over the place. And a lot of people don't understand them and don't know what they are and don't know what to do when the bill comes in the mail.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, in my conversations reporting on this story, I talked to so many people, many of which are not even quoted in the story, just trying to understand it. And I got to the point where I was having conversations where I'm trying to explain this and someone saying, but how is that legal? How can they just bill you for something that you don't even get? And how can they do that? And I had to just say, I don't know. It's in Idaho code. It's just the way it is. So the moral of this story is, if you are in a water user association, you should probably pay your bill because they could put a lien on your house. And if you're in the Chevrolateral Water User Association and you've been having problems, you should call me.
Well, and I think a lot of people are in water users associations and just don't know it. And I think you're right. It is kind of a no man's land for a lot of places. And it's fascinating that not only are you looking at it, but that the Attorney General's office is asking questions, which I haven't heard of them doing like this before.
I'll see if they proceed and send more letters and open up an investigation. If they do, then I will have a follow-up story. So just keep your eyes peeled.
All right. And Clark, before you take us into the zone of death, Margaret, give us a quick update on Micron and Idaho. Boise Dev did a little bit about what's going on with Micron and expansion and the CHIPS Act. Break it down for us.
So we are still in limbo, waiting to see what Micron is going to do. They have signaled that if the CHIPS Act, which was this massive package to fund semiconductor manufacturers across the United States, passed, they would expand. But they keep saying they have not decided where. Our reporting on BoiseDev.com over the last, you know, several months, stretching back to last year, pointed to Boise being in play for a large expansion, potentially a fab, which would construct chips, very big operation, hundreds of jobs, maybe more. And so this would be a big boost to the region. And so Micron has not said they've made a decision, but earlier this month, they filed applications for incentives, property tax incentives down in Texas to potentially build an 8-phase plant in Lockhart, which is a suburb of Austin. But whenever we reached out to the company yesterday to ask them, said, hey, does this mean that you've made a decision that Boise is out of the running? They didn't say that. They said that they had applied for the incentives because they were knew they were going to be expiring in 2022. They wanted to, quote unquote, preserve their options. And there was an interesting quote in an article by the Austin Business Journal, I believe, that talked about, well, because of Texas's really high property taxes, you know, we're really going to need this incentive in order to open here. And that points to something very interesting. I think it doesn't necessarily sound definitive on Micron's part, both because of the quote, the spokesperson saying they're preserving their options, and the fact that they value property taxes. You got an important thing to remember about Micron and Boise is that they have their property taxes capped in Idaho. They could build the biggest, fanciest, coolest thing in the world over there and not pay a cent more in property taxes. And this is because of a bill passed by the Idaho legislature during the Great Recession that was intending to try and lure a nuclear company called Areva out to East Idaho. But instead, the nuclear company never came, but instead Micron was able to take advantage of that incentive, and they have quite the property tax break here in Idaho. And then you layer that on top of potential partnerships with the city of Boise for water recycling, which would be important to a semiconductor manufacturing outfit, and an incentive package passed in the Idaho legislature this year, Idaho is very, very likely still in play. So keep watching.
We will. It's fascinating. And it will, one way or another, affect Boise quite a bit. Clark, I think you had the most fun this week with your story about hiking deep into the roadless backcountry of Yellowstone National Park. And first off, we all envy you. You wrote about the zone of death. Tell us about your trip, what the zone of death is, and how much fun it was to go where nobody else goes in Yellowstone.
Yeah, Sam, thanks so much. I'm super excited to talk about this. I think this is probably the favorite story that I've ever written in my career. But yeah, I spent 4 days in the backcountry of Yellowstone National Park, and the goal was to finish in the zone of death. And just a real quick primer on what the zone of death is. It's kind of what it actually is it's the Idaho section of Yellowstone National Park. You know, most of Yellowstone is located in Wyoming, but a few small sections extend into Montana and then into Idaho. And so the Idaho section, some people call it the zone of death. And there's this legal theory that holds that because no one lives in the zone of death, it might be really difficult to prosecute somebody for a federal felony if they asked for their constitutional right to be tried by a jury from the district where the crime was committed. This is even something that the Idaho legislature took a look at earlier this year. They basically adopted a non-binding memorial asking Congress to take a look at this. And that was basically all I needed to go and talk to my editor and say, I think it's my journalistic duty to go deep into the backcountry of Yellowstone and find out about this place. But I just had so much fun. I went with Heath Drusen, who's a Boise journalist who's worked with Boise State Public Radio. He hosts the Extremely American podcast. And we set up this epic trip going through 52 miles of Yellowstone backcountry. We basically left our car behind near the Old Faithful parking area and walked southwest into the roadless section of Yellowstone. We had another vehicle waiting at the Idaho-Wyoming border. And for 3 days, we hiked over the Continental Divide. We passed backcountry geysers and hot springs. We ate fresh huckleberries. We camped in these backcountry remote sites. And it was just incredible. It's rugged. It's remote. There's no roads. In the Idaho section, in the zone of death, the trail is so faint and so hard to follow that the rangers warned us that it could be a little tricky getting out there, and it could be a little tricky finding our campsite. But I described it as one of the last wild places in the American West. You know, Yellowstone gets millions of visitors every year, but very, very few people go into the backcountry, and even fewer people go into the Idaho section of the backcountry. There's a couple reasons why. A, it's hard to get to, but B, it's kind of overshadowed by some of the more popular stuff kind of close by in Wyoming. Big, colorful geyser basins and waterfalls and stuff like that. That kind of draws the crowds. And so almost nobody goes to the zone of death. But Yellowstone's celebrating its 150th anniversary this year. The park actually predates Idaho statehood. And I talked to one of the longest serving backcountry rangers in Yellowstone. And we just had this awesome conversation about how cool the backcountry is. It really is this place that hasn't changed much in the 150 years since the park was established. And to get to the zone of death, we went through big river crossings. You know, on our first day, we hiked 20 miles in one day. And it was just so cool to visit this amazing place, this jewel in our country's history, Yellowstone, and to get away from the cars and the crowds and the traffic. And the Idaho part was so faint and so remote, it was a little bit hard to find the trail at some points. There was some bushwhacking involved, but we just had the coolest trip. If you go to idahocapitalsun.com and search for Zone of Death, I had some awesome photos. And I really want to thank Christina Lords, my editor, for letting me go on this trip and just writing this long story, kind of going day by day through our hike, through our journey. And the other cool thing has been I've gotten emails from people all across the country who read the story and talked about how much they loved it and how they could tell that we were just having so much fun. So I think it's the most fun story that I've ever done. And I was super excited to have this much fun on a story that's kind of related to the Idaho legislature.
Well, when you think about it, relating the Idaho legislature to Mr. Bubbles, can you tell us what Mr. Bubbles was in 60 seconds or less?
This fantastic backcountry hot spring in the middle of Yellowstone National Park that's a little bit hard to get to. It's the size of a swimming pool. It's in a geyser basin. And the reason we can even get into it is because you've got cold water from a creek flowing in and mixing with this big hot pool. And it's called Mr. Bubbles because it literally bubbles up from the very middle of this pool. And it's one of my favorite places that I've ever visited. Mr. Bubbles is actually in the Wyoming section. And we included that in our journey towards Idaho, towards the zone of death. Thanks. And I just had so much fun, and I've loved hearing from people who've read the article.
It's awesome. And there are great pictures. We'll put a link to your story. Go check out the pictures. Check out the journey. It is amazing. Okay, we want to thank everybody who joined us today. Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press and the voice of the Eye on Boise blog. Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman. And Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com. We couldn't do it without you. Thank you so much, guys.
Have a great weekend.
I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat. Make it a great Friday. Have a great weekend. And come back on Monday.